I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Garth Mullins joins me now, the activist, writer, speaker, award-winning broadcaster, musician, joins me today for an extended chat on matters political and more. There's a municipal election in November, and perhaps I can get Mr. Mullins to mull on that or other political matters nationally and internationally. He writes on his own website at garthmullins.com, as well as for sundry publications including Vice, the Georgia Strait, Rabble.ca, Megaphone. His radio work on CBC Radio has garnered him a Jack Webster Award. His recent documentary, The End of the Dial, which aired on Ideas, was great radio. If you care about radio, it's necessary listening. It highlights the renaissance it's having on both public and private airwaves, not to mention online. It's also a fine love letter to a medium that has entertained and inspired Garth and people like him who use radio. He's long been a fixture in the media and protests across the country. Like many, I came to know Mr. Mullins through his activism, appearances at rallies and protests that made the evening news. He still cares, and I'll get him to reflect on that and more. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in studio, as it were, Garth Mullins. Mr. Mullins, good morning.
Thanks, Joe. Good to be here.
Thanks for coming in to do this. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Well, it's good to meet you, too.
You follow politics, I'm sure, and you have for a long time.
Yeah.
We have a municipal election coming up in November. Do you think it's too early to figure out where we are in that and what'll happen, say, after the November election?
You know, I have a number of predictions on it, but, you know, I have no expertise that anybody else doesn't have. I just look around and I see the progressive left is not in a great state of unity, and that developers will probably have a great deal of influence in City Hall, as they have for 95% of its existence.
Now, are you involved with COPE at all?
You know, I've spoken at a couple of COPE events, but I'm not, I'm not a party activist. I don't have a dog in that fight. I mean, I'm a social movement organizer, as you said at the top of the show there, and I continue to see the ability to hold governments of any stripe accountable through a mass mobilization of just regular citizens.
And so what have you made of the last 6 years or so of Vision Vancouver?
Well, you know, I see a continuation of the sort of pro-development, mega-project style of government, where we're just building lots of glass and chrome condo towers that have high-end suites inside. I've seen a continual exclusion of people who are not extremely wealthy from the city, and it harder and harder to live here.
That's something that ever since we've come to know you over the years, the last 15 years or so, I mean, you've talked a lot about affordability in Vancouver, and that's something that's talked about a lot in recent years. Just because people talk about it doesn't mean they're really doing anything to solve the issue. What do you make in terms of where we are in terms of making? I mean, it doesn't look like Vancouver will become any affordable anytime soon.
Well, it's true. The difficulty is with the model right now. And, you know, I'm not against more people living here. In fact, East Van has always been a really welcoming place for people from all over the world, from all over the country and all over the world, and I wouldn't want to see that change. What I wouldn't want to see is people being displaced, so that folks who are wealthy are displacing folks who aren't. And in terms of what to do about that, I mean, that's a key question, but it's overturning a certain model of development that we have in this city, in this country, in Western industrialized democracies, really almost everywhere around the world I'm seeing is engaging in these kinds of gentrification efforts, I guess. It's getting more and more expensive to live in cities anyway. And for my neighborhood, the Grandview Woodland, there's been a plan to put quite a lot of these high-end condo towers all over the neighborhood. Started last summer, I guess it started before then, but I became aware of it, as a lot of other people did, when the local area plan was revealed in its draft form with 39 stories or 37 stories at the Safeway site of Broadway and Commercial, and many, many other similar but shorter condo towers, and they would have a big economic effect on everywhere else in the neighborhood.
People know that's the one next the Safeway. That's the one next to the Broadway SkyTrain station.
That's right.
Yeah. And so they were. You said 37 tower stories.
Yeah, that was. I mean, the most noticeable and shocking thing about the local area plan is that there was this incredible density right around a transit system that is over capacity right now, and that it was primarily going to be condos that, that people can buy that are very expensive, you know, $500,000 or more, and, you know, $500,000 or more dollars, and that there would be other such buildings around different intersections in different spots, up Commercial Drive, down Broadway, on Nanaimo, throughout Grandview Woodland. And I think myself and lots of people in the community were quite shocked. It would change the whole face of this part of East Vancouver, for sure.
And displace a lot of people that are there already, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's already gotten quite expensive. Rental stock is on the decline, and these buildings would be built right over top of where existing rental stock is right now.
So is there a happy medium, perhaps, in terms of where we can all coexist, do you think?
I think we can all coexist very easily. I mean, the existing zoning allows for quite a bit more building in East Vancouver. You know, people are already densifying houses. I don't know, a lot of houses that I've lived in have lots of different roommates living in a house, and there's carriage houses you can build on the back. People can build more houses more densely packed, low-rise apartment rentals like the classic East Van. You can fit a lot more people into Grandview Woodland by doing that. Sorry, go ahead.
You know, why isn't it happening then? I mean, do you think that the city planners, developers want a different class of citizen to live in these neighborhoods, perhaps?
Well, I don't know about that, but I know that, large corporate condo developers have a great influence at City Hall, and the mega project provides some of the services right now for the city. So the city allows for a little bit more height, and in return, the developer builds a park or a little daycare center or some service, which traditionally one would think that's what ratepayers pay their taxes for. The city provides parks, and that's the arrangement we all have. But the city is more and more abdicating that responsibility to developers.
So these so-called amenities,
that's right,
are sort of social programs that government should pay for, but are ceding control of that to developers.
That's right, and the trade-off just isn't worth it.
Yeah,
this neighborhood, or Grandview Woodland, is a traditional home of the left. It's home of trade unionists, artists, gays and lesbians, people from all over the world. Those kind of folks, we're going to get displaced in this sort of mad dash, wild west of condo towers and real estate speculation. You can already see how expensive it's gotten to live around here.
So is COPE then the only alternative to Vision Vancouver?
Well, you know, I'm not so sure about that.
They're pretty divided, aren't they?
Yeah, they're divided, but I see also the solution being being coming from below, you know, a social movement organizing. And I take you back to the 37-story condo tower, is that we began to organize and put a lot of pressure on the city government, and they started to withdraw some of the most egregious points of that proposal last summer. And right now we're about to engage in something called a citizens assembly. Not sure what that's going to look like. It's a city consultation effort, which is expanded from previous efforts. I don't know whether it will bear fruit or whether it will be a sort of a rubber stamp legitimization process. But in any event, you can see that if you put pressure, that kind of political pressure, on the city, you start to endanger its base, because Vision Vancouver still has sort of a coalition of support, which has to include some middle progressive elements, I suppose. If you start to splinter that or threaten to splinter that, then the city does react, the government does react, and I think that's the best way to do it. Whatever happens in November of this year at the election, I think that the developers are still going to have a great stranglehold on City Hall, and so we have to fight that from the neighborhoods, not just from the city council chamber.
And in your travels throughout the city, do you find that the people themselves are interested in these issues, that they do care enough to mobilize, perhaps?
Well, I think there's a very persuasive feeling that we can't change things, and that you face that with every single social issue, every kind of fight. You know, a lot of people aren't bought off, people aren't stupid, people don't believe Fox News. I think that I'm not smarter than anybody else, but there is a very persuasive idea that we can't change anything, and I feel that too sometimes. I feel the defeat of overwhelming odds, but you know, I think that there are examples of where we can change things, and if you love your neighborhood, if you love your city, you have no choice but to fight for it.
Yeah, you've been involved in many fights, many years of activism. I mean, you're still an activist, I guess. I mean, that's how people know you, have come to know you. How do you deal with, say defeat? I mean, you have to not only to defeat, say, big business or governments, but, you know, the apathy of people around you. How have you dealt with that over the years?
Sometimes effectively, sometimes not. Sometimes I found it really, really demoralizing and dispiriting, and I stick my head in the sand for a while. You know, you go back, you lick your wounds, maybe you read, or you just get out of it for a little bit, but I think if you're in it for life, you've got to realize that there will be defeats. You know, this is the nature of fighting. The most difficult fight that there is the fight against, entrenched, really well-funded interests. And people can reflect on that anywhere in the world. But, you know, when you see what happens in different spots in the world, wherever there's oppression or marginalization, people are fighting. And that's the one universal truth that I see, is where the boot comes down, people push back. And so if I'm not doing it, I watch people who are, and I try and be inspired by that.
Was APEC in the, I guess that was 1997, was that the first time that we sort of, I mean, for me, that was the first time that I sort of remember you.
Oh, I remember myself many years earlier before that, yeah, but it's fuzzy.
but in terms of getting out there and making the news, say, through protests and the sort, was that really when the public started to get to know you?
Well, I guess I've been involved in a lot of struggles before that, and I've been on the news before that, but, you know, you keep doing your work, and sometimes the media pays attention, and sometimes it doesn't, so, you know, it's hard to say. I remember in high school, a group of young friends and I tried to blockade some U.S. nuclear warships from entering the harbor here, and we were in very small crafts. We all got swamped and pulled ourselves out of the water, and there were certainly news cameras interested in that, and then concerned parents, and then high school suspensions and everything else that goes with it. But, you know, sometimes it's the flavor of the day. You know, there was a lot of news interest, and then on September 10th, 2001, that absolutely dissipated. The news changed its focus, and this happens all the time.
And then, I guess, WTO in Seattle, you were involved in that as well?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. What are you proudest of?
Geez, you know, I don't know. That's a difficult question.
Did you feel that you've affected change, though, in your community?
I guess, it's hard to measure because you're just one grain of sand on a giant beach. So I guess I'm proudest of being able to get to know people in different parts of the world here in Canada, and get to work and travel to places that I wouldn't have get to see otherwise. From the front lines of different struggles to remote indigenous communities. And I feel really, I guess, maybe pride isn't the right word, but privileged, really lucky and that people have taken the time to help show me and teach me and make me have a better, more well-rounded view of the world.
I mean, a lot of this stuff that you talked about with regards to the Olympics, warning us of the perils of that. I mean, a lot of those things have come to pass, haven't they?
Yeah, I don't mean to say I told you so.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think you should. I mean, even those of us who like, I mean, I didn't care for the Olympics, and I really didn't care one way or the other. Some of the things that you and Chris Shaw said at the time, I mean, I probably listened to it, but I didn't really care enough to do anything as well. But I mean, these issues of affordability and the sort, I mean, they have, I mean, to use a trite phrase, I mean, these chickens have come home to roost, right?
Yeah, and if you've lived in the city long enough, you've seen Expo come and go.
Yeah.
And so everything comes around again. The Olympics was another sort of very expensive party, well sponsored, and a lot of corporate presence, and the city spent all of its grocery money holding a party instead of paying the rent and buying your groceries. And so now when it comes time to actually do something regular for the citizens, aside from make a sliding center or whatever, the money isn't there. You have to rely on condo developers, and it's gotten a more expensive place to live. You just look at where else the Olympics goes. I mean, I used to live in Hackney in East London. It's the same story there, and it's sad to have to go follow it and watch it go from place to place to place, causing the same sort of ravages.
You were born here, though, right?
No, I wasn't.
Oh, where were you born?
Ottawa.
In Ottawa.
And yeah, then I grew up in the Northwest Territories.
I see. Yeah. Okay, and then you came out here to go to UBC, is that right?
Well, my academic career is a long and storied thing, but I actually graduated from the London School of Economics in the UK.
Ah.
And so I have a Master's of Science from there or whatever, and you know, I got about a halfway doctorate from UBC.
I see. So. When did you go into to say sort of practice journalism, if you will? I mean, you've in recent weeks have done great work in terms of talking about methadone, and I guess you broke the vending machine that sold crack pipes on Vice, didn't you?
It broke the story. Hope I didn't break the machine. Yeah, I don't know. I'm a writer, you know. I don't know if I would fear for people to call me a journalist because there's a certain sort of well, at least a mantle of objectivity that's supposed to go along with that. And I'm not objective. I'm very clear about whose side I take and where my roots are and what I'm talking about. So, you know, covering the crack pipe vending machine, for example, I don't say, here's a machine, decide for yourself. I say, this is excellent. This is awesome. This is harm reduction in practice with great design. And we should applaud the people who thought of it. You know, so that, and the same with methadone. I'm not saying... you know, here's some information. I'm saying they changed the methadone. They made it 10 times stronger at the beginning of February. And to not warn patients and other drug users who might be on the street, who might come into contact with it, is a public health crime. And they did. They did because of organizations like the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users and BC Association of People on Methadone. They got together, and people like myself put pressure on the regulators and the associations that control methadone prescription in BC, and they did warn people.
Yeah, I guess after your work came out, I did see signs and the sort throughout the city.
Yeah, that's right. We put pressure. We also made signs and put up signs. So
You have a Webster, so one assumes that you're a journalist if you've got one of those things. So you don't see. I mean, you see yourself still as an activist first and foremost.
Yeah, I mean, that's the truth of who I am. And so, you know, there is a good tradition of advocacy journalism and activists as journalists and revolutionaries as journalists, you know, especially in earlier in the 20th century.
Yeah.
You know, newspapers used to say, this is the Tory paper, this is the Labour paper, whatever. There used to be just workers' papers. And so it's, you know, it's fair enough. But in the current context, I always feel that it's good to good to warn people what we mean by the writing that I do anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I just don't want that to be held against me in some way.
No, but I mean, as someone who looks at these things sort of, well, somewhat objectively, I mean, you're a pretty good writer. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with a lot of, some of the things that you write about, but I mean, or take the worldview that you do, but I mean, you are a pretty good writer. And so do you think that comes from, well, I'll ask you where you think that comes from.
When I got awarded the Webster, it's a Jack Webster Foundation Journalism
yeah.
Award for a radio piece, it wasn't just me, it was myself and my partner, Lisa Hale. And my good writing comes from Lisa Hale, who's here with us. She looks at it before it goes out. She says, is that really true? Look at that. Is that really, you should fact check that, you know, and you're being a little too colloquial right there. So I think it comes a lot from... again, you know, collective efforts, like and having good sources too. You know, just having a great network of people in the community here who I can call up and ask something I don't understand, or ask what's going on, or who call me and tell me.
Yeah. So, what you're doing now, is this what you've always wanted to do?
Oh, I don't know. It's just. I mean, the first time I got paid for writing, I think, was in the Vancouver Sun more than a decade ago, and. So I've done writing, always, but the difference now is I've gotten over my fear of self-promotion, so I actually tweet it out and
yeah.
Facebook it a little bit. I never used to do that because I just, I guess I felt a little, I don't know, uncomfortable with that, but, you know, everybody does it. You got to do it. If you don't tell people, they won't know. So.
Yeah, that's where I guess I saw the tweets about this documentary that you did about a month ago, End of the Dial for Ideas. I read about that online, and then I went to go listen to it. How often do you commit radio? I mean, you have this podcast, East Van Podcast. How often do you do that, and then do you say sort of the documentary stuff that you do for CBC?
Well, the podcast is East Van Calling.
And, East Van Calling,
yeah,
pardon me.
I guess there's about 10 or 12 of them, I can't remember, and they're pretty irregular. But it's, you know, it's when you're working on a project and you end up gathering some audio and you just, you know, I like radio, so I try to put it together as a podcast. And every year we seem to make about an hour of radio for CBC Ideas, you know, a documentary. This year it was End of the Dial, which was about the future of radio. And, well, you said at the top of the program, you know, a bit of a love letter to radio and its progressive potential.
Mm-hmm.
And last year was a show called The Imaginary Albino, which was about people with albinism, like myself, you know, lack of pigment in the skin, hair, and eyes, really bad eyesight. And it was a show that took us around the world to representations of people with albinism in cinema and, you know, thinking back to the sideshow, the freak show, back in the, actually not so long ago, 30, 40 years ago was the last of them. But sort of most disturbing for me was to talk to people who come from Tanzania and who live in East Africa, where there's a strange, very gruesome black market trade in albino body parts. So people get murdered and attacked who have albinism, and they, you know, we get our, you know, toes and arms and legs and bones and blood ground up and sold as a bogus sort of potion that can bring good luck or something like that. Very modern phenomena that's come with, you know, free markets and mining into Tanzania, not something that used to really happen around there a lot, but the BBC uncovered this about 2006, and we did some reporting on it. That's what won the Webster, and that program was also used as evidence in the UN Human Rights Council meetings, where a motion was put forward to end this violence.
Yeah, I mean, I just listened to it last night. It's moving, chilling stuff on there.
Yeah, it's hard to listen to. It's probably not for younger ears, because we do talk to people who have survived these kind of attacks. And we also talk to activists who are fighting back against these kind of attacks. So it sort of shows, it shows the strange, terrible ideas about people with albinism in the West and in East Africa, and sort of traces the history a little bit.
Do you think you're raising awareness with regards to that here? At least?
I know we are. Absolutely. Yeah. When that show went to air, in fact, every time they repeat broadcast it, we get a flood of email, and CBC gets a bunch of email, and you know, people want to know how to help how we can put them in contact with people. And you get people with albinism that call in. You know, we got a guy who has albinism who never knew how to talk about it, never knew how to sort of explain his lived reality to his family and his partner. And he sat them down and played the show to them as a way to describe the struggle that you go through. It's, you know, it's a disability, so people with albinism experience the same kind of marginalization from mainstream society in Canada that anybody with a disability does.
Yeah, there's some moving stuff on that piece. You talk to your parents, and then you talk to a parent.
Yes.
I guess this was at a convention that
yeah, that's right.
You folks have? I mean, it sounds silly to say that, but...
Well, I had never been... You know, there is this this organization internationally that every couple of years holds a conference, and it brings together people with albinism from all over the world, as well as their parents and partners, friends, loved ones, whatever. And so I had never really met anybody with albinism before. It's really rare, you know, 1 in 20,000 people has albinism or something like that. So you don't run into people that look like you ever in life, except for, you know, when you go to see the Matrix and you see that, you know, the evil twins with that are, you know, chasing Neo around, or you know, the Da Vinci Code with that guy, the assassin guy who's, you know, got the pale hair and, you know, whips himself or whatever. So it was really crazy to go and suddenly meet 400 people that really looked a lot like you. And Lisa came there with me, and she can find me really easily. I'm 6'4" and I have platinum hair. You can't miss me. But all of a sudden, when there's all these other dudes that have a squint and white hair loping around, then you can't find me anymore. It was a really strange experience to suddenly, for a moment, not be in a tiny minority. So yeah, it was. They have this meeting. We met a lot of people there, including this parent, Carrie Ringlentz, and she's from Calgary. Mm-hmm. And she told us that she had a kid with albinism that she found out when the kid was born. You know, she cried when we were interviewing her. I said, "What was your reaction?" And she remembered, and she found it, you know, really upsetting. She did a little research. She understood what albinism was. She's gotten to know her baby, who's, you know, now a few years old. And and then she said to us she wouldn't want to have a kid without albinism now. So she has a entirely positive attitude toward it. Yeah. It seemed.
Yeah, I guess what your work has done is it's not only informed a lot of people. It's also quite funny. I mean, you're a pretty funny guy. But it also gives voice and sort of a language that we can all understand in terms of what albinism is. I mean, I certainly didn't know very much about it until I listened to that show.
Well, you know, nobody does, and in fact, I didn't really. I worked on all these different social justice causes throughout my life, but I never looked at this thing that I am. I never really went to try and understand it.
Yeah.
Until a couple years ago, and I was obviously running away or hiding away from something, and so I guess it was time to have a look at it and go meet people who were like myself. And I think, well, I found out that lots of other people with albinism have this same thing, where they feel really alienated and like ashamed, embarrassed, hiding from this condition. You know, obviously you can't, everybody else can see you, but people with albinism are in the same place. They don't know anything about the condition, or mostly they don't. You hear some sort of high school textbook genetic explanation of how you came to be, you know, recessive gene, this, that, the other, but the social lived reality, we are finding out ourselves as we meet each other, I guess.
Has this piece of work, has this changed your life at all? I mean, are you a different person after it all?
I am more whole. There isn't a big part of me that's missing. There isn't a big, I think it's healing. There isn't a big piece of damage in me about disability, about albinism. You know, a couple of years ago, I wouldn't be able to have a conversation like this. I wouldn't be able to talk about it with one person, never mind whoever's listening on this and who was listening on the CBC when we aired the show. So it was extremely challenging, but it was also really liberating too, to be able to make friends with a part of who you are that you were never able to understand, that you were alienated from.
Yeah, and so the radio documentary that aired about a month ago, you've gotten a lot of reaction to that, have you?
Oh yeah, we you know, after you do the imaginary albino and you have this big emotional journey, you kind of think, well, let's do something that's not so heavy, you know. And you know, we loved making radio together. Lisa and I got married last year. Uh-huh. And so we thought, what a nice kind of way to share something. And we got great reaction to it. I thought it would be a lot quieter, but there's this huge society of people who love radio out there. There's lots of people who are like you, you know, plugging their mic in their basement and making radio themselves, not waiting for some official invitation from CBC or whatever, you know. And lots of those sort of folks listened to it and wrote us a letter, or email, or whatever.
And radio is doing well. I mean, you look at the ratings in terms of how the CBC is doing across the country. It's doing quite well. Podcasts, obviously, on the internet are doing well. But, I mean, even satellite radio, listening to regular radio, commercial radio, if you will, through these different means on your iPod, on your phone, in your car. I mean, it has come back in a way, hasn't it? I mean, or I guess it was always there, but we're just more aware now of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's all radio, whether it's podcast or broadcast or beamed directly to your skull. Yeah. It's all the same thing, you know, an audio signal that you get and that you listen to without video, without interruption. You know, you can't write an email back to it and interrupt the flow of the conversation. And I think that people realize in a more and more fragmented media environment how great it is to just hear a human voice talking to you about something that happened to them.
Yeah, and there's a lot of entertaining stuff out there, too. I mean, and what I found very interesting about your piece was about how it affected your life in terms of how you learned a great deal about, you know, your activism and the sort, how you used radio in that regard. You've heard different voices from overseas, even.
As a teenager during Reagan, Thatcher, mm-hmm. and the worst sort of cultural yuppieism. You grow up in there, you just don't know, or you just sometimes can't see that there is anybody who is outside of that. And you turn on the radio and you just hear all these different kind of voices from struggles and perspectives all over the world. This was shortwave radio, and I just found it incredibly life-saving to know there was something outside of the sort of, the pressure cooker that was a 1980s sort of Thatcherite world.
Yeah, and you talked to some terrific people on that show as well, Ira Glass and Elizabeth Hay. That book, I mean, that's pretty much the book to read if you want to.
Late Nights on Air,
yeah.
Elizabeth Hay. Yeah, I mean, that's terrific. I mean, I grew up in the North in the time she was talking about. And, you know, she was on the radio when I was a kid listening to the radio in Yellowknife. And I read the book and I was like, yeah, that was my experience. That was my memory. I mean, my family went on canoe trips, like the canoe trip. I mean, the same canoe trip that she went on. I mean, we didn't lose somebody on the canoe trip, but we had, you know, the same kind of strange little logistical upsets, or a bear hangs around our camp too much or whatever like that. And I mean, she just, and my whole family read the book too. And they all felt it. I mean, pictures of her in a canoe in her, you know, 70s or 80s era life jacket looks the same as us, you know.
Yeah. So are you and Lisa working on another piece now, or working?
Yeah.
On more
we are definitely.
Yeah. Can you tell us about it, or is it?
Can't tell you about it yet, but it won't be on the radio for quite a while. But it's, you won't be able to predict what it is based on what we've talked about here today.
Those programs that you both do, I mean, they're wonderfully produced. I mean, they must be time consuming, are they?
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's. I mean, you have to definitely love to do it, because it's very time intensive and really fiddly and. You know.
You have to be nimble with a mouse and a sword, I guess.
I guess you do, and I've played music my whole life, so I've just, and also not being able to see really well, I just feel so comfortable in sound and in sound editing that it's very simple. You know, I built my own recording studio when I was a kid, you know, I was like maybe 12, out of two tape decks that I got to run at the same time, and a little mixing board and some mics and stuff, you know. So I just have always felt really at home there. I think it shouldn't be intimidating for people, though. You don't have to make a super slick, well-produced thing with 500 sound cues like we had at End of the Dial. You can just turn on the mic and do it, you know. It's just a good story. It's nice to have great sound. We love great sound, but a good story, that's just what you needed. Yeah. Ability to tell stories and not get lost in radio speak is like this, or this is how you present, or you got to sound like a public radio voice or something. You just do it.
What else is next for you?
You know, I guess we'll be watching and working over the next few months up until the election in November to try and at least create a counterpoll to this build condos everywhere. You know, and I think there is starting to be some movement around that. You know, it used to be this Vancouverism philosophy that it was just great to put high-end condos up to the sky. And certainly I'm not for urban sprawl. It's not a height thing for me. But it's a type of planning that you cannot have endless increased density without social justice. You just can't be displacing people who aren't wealthy enough to buy $500,000 condos. It's It's not on. I don't want to live in a city like that. I think most people don't either. So I think continuing to work on that will be a big part of what we do.
And because we've talked about this throughout the last half an hour or so about how you feel Vancouver should be. Do you think the goals that you have, they're achievable under the framework, under the leadership that you see throughout the city?
You know, it's weird because Vancouver's a process as opposed to an endpoint. It's a constant war between two Vancouvers. People come here all the time and you can see this image of Vancouver that people put onto the world stage of, you know, a great outdoor lifestyle and gleaming condo towers and, you know, local organic fare and whatever. And I mean, the food is good. Believe me, I don't want to go have a Big Mac, but there's more to it. And there's actually another Vancouver here right underneath all the time that people who live here, especially in East Van, know. And I think it's the conflict between those two Vancouvers that actually makes this city. So you get Bob Rennie, but you also get Mark Townsend. You know, you get a guy who just wants to promote condo towers forever, but you also get people who were involved, and many more than Mark Townsend, involved in creating Insight, a safe injection site, against all the laws, against everything. I mean, we started with actually guerrilla injection sites. Before it was legal, people just set them up, safe injection sites here. And that's the true story of Vancouver. The architecture of this side of the city, even the smallest points, are a result of struggle. If you go across the train tracks in Strathcona over a pedestrian bridge, that was the result of mothers fighting for safety for their kids. The city is built by struggle, and that's how the city will continue to be. So it won't be the goals of the strugglers, but it will be something different. It will be the trajectory of developers impacted and countered by the trajectory of people like me, and it'll be something different. I guess that's what makes it interesting. So I don't know if the goals will be achievable, but I at least hope to frustrate the goals of people who would make this a rich enclave.
And you are generally still hopeful, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you have to be. Maybe I'm completely deluded, but you have to be. And also, there's so much cool stuff here. We walk a lot. We walk as a major form of transportation, and just the people and the things that happen in the city are really cool. There's a lot of good stuff. The struggle for me is, how do you organize and connect all those nodes of greatness into something that's as strong, or that can be at least a counterpole, you know, have as much enough gravity to offset the very well-organized forces of development.
It's been such a pleasure to meet you and to talk to you today. I appreciate you coming in to do this, and best of luck to you and Lisa in all your future endeavors.
Oh, thanks for having us, Joe. It's really nice.
The website's for more, garthmullins.com, and you can hear the podcast, or East Van Calling. And then, of course, the ideas broadcasts for some of Garth's work on there. The End of the Dial piece, of course, and then the Imaginary Albino. That's at cbc.ca/ideas. Garth Mullins joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.